Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 344 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Mark Rubin down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
And we also have Jaime Lopez Jr. as usual on the line in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
All right. And I just want to point out we're recording on the second day of the second month of 2022. So this is officially 2-2-2-2. And I sent you guys a text message at roughly 2:22 today. Did you get it?
I did. Yeah,
I did. Did you not get the
response?
Did
you open it at 2:22? I got the response. Yeah, I was trying to explain to my granddaughter, she's here for the evening, what the significance of the date was, and she's like, I don't get it.
But, you know, in 20 days, you're going to be celebrating again, because it'll be 2:22:22.
Really?
February 22nd, right?
Okay. All right.
Isn't that even better?
Put that on the calendar for sure.
And if you make it in another 200 years, it'll be even better.
Well, that's what Carol was saying earlier today, but I don't think I'm going to make it there. Yeah. I don't think you're going to make it there either.
No.
Jaime might have an outside chance.
Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, Jaime might get the new iBody from Apple in a few years.
Right.
You know, he'll be able to live that long.
I don't know. Jaime's catching up to us, I think. Sorry, Jaime.
Yeah,
that's how that works. Asymptotically, you start, you know, dealing with age where you're just effectively infinite at some point.
Yeah,
there's no difference between, you know, 500 and 1,000. It's like that's basically infinite. There's no reason to keep track anymore.
Once you're past 35, you're just old to everyone under 30. So we're all the same.
Yeah. All right. So a little bit of fact check to begin the show. We were talking about the Apple Car project, and apparently the code name that they run under is Titan. At least that's what the rumor mill has going for it. So, yeah, I couldn't remember the name of the Apple Car project or the supposed Apple Car project. We were debating, BuddyBuild.com. If you go to BuddyBuild.com now, it redirects you to Xcode Cloud. So I think it's safe to say that Xcode Cloud is a product built on top of BuddyBuild. What do you think about that? Sounds reasonable?
Sounds reasonable.
Makes sense to me, and it does sort of answer... You know, we had wondered many, many years ago, you know, what did they do with them? Nothing had struck us as like immediately obvious other than a few test flight sort of nice features. We're like, well, it does more than that. You know, where's the other stuff? And it looks like they've gone the way of building presumably all of this, you know, big amount of infrastructure to make that possible, which presumably takes time to do. You can't just say, oh, cool, just copy and paste over the code from BuddyBuild and call it good.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, well, and the thing is, like, you know, having seen the BuddyBuild demos starting in 2014 at NS North, it very much sounds like what xCloud is sort of doing, right, in terms of, you know, how it's interfacing, you know, how easy it is to get a build going, you know, that kind of stuff, and invite people to test flights and that kind of stuff, right? Even though it wasn't, was it test flight? I can't remember, but I do remember that, you know, you handed over the keys to your account, and then Buddy Build would, you know, integrate it into your Xcode builds and stuff like that. So it sounds very much like a proper CI kind of solution, right? But using the cloud at the time, right? That's what they were doing. All right. So we had an MTJU, we're calling it, crossover, the more than just code universe, or more than just universe. I guess it's MTJPU, right? Story that we talked about it last week on Spotcast, but we're going to talk about it here again today because it's relevant. So obviously for Spotcast, we're into, you know, sci-fi and characters and stuff like that. And the story came out of the Toronto Star last week that the stars of X-Men and Avengers had assembled to invest in a record $620 million US into Toronto AgileBits product 1Password. And so that was kind of an interesting story. Congratulations to our pals over at 1Password. I think I mentioned, clearly we had Roustam on a few weeks ago on one of our, or I guess last month, on this show here talking about his career and where 1Password came from and some of the things that they sort of went through and changing their business, evolving, growing, obviously, larger. So we've got people like Matthew McConaughey, Rita Wilson, Ashton Kutcher, Trevor Noah, Justin Timberlake, Pharrell Williams, as well as Ryan Williams, as in Scarlett Johansson's Robert Downey Jr., and Chris Evans. And I'm sure it's probably just their, whatever companies are involved in, they're doing the investing. It's not, I don't know if it would be necessarily them specifically, right?
Well, actually, these celebrity investors, they generally do, it is their own money, and it's, they maybe have a person who's, you know, searching out the opportunities and connecting them with the companies, but, you know, very often, yeah, the celebrity themselves will just go to the site and meet the people and write a check. In my last startup, we had a couple of those who were involved as investors, not those particular ones you mentioned, but, you know, people of that stature.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah.
But yeah, $620 million is a pretty sizable investment. I mean, that values them at, you know, probably several billion dollars.
$6.8 billion.
Oh, $6.8 billion. Okay. Wow. Yeah.
That's so nice. The valuation is 45 times the expected revenue for 2021 of $150 million, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
It's quite the ratio. Yeah,
that's not too surprising for a growing company, I would say. You know, for an established company, you know, price to sales is, you know, maybe around 10 or something like that. Although these days stuff is expensive, so maybe mm-hmm. maybe even higher. But yeah, for a growing company, you're paying for what you think it's going to be worth in a couple of years or whatever. So 45, you know, if you think it's growing a lot, then 45 seems not unreasonable.
Yeah, there was an article. I don't think it was this one, but there was one that talked about businesses accounting for 60% of their revenue. So I think a lot of the sort of investment interest here is growth in that
mm-hmm.
business mm-hmm. sort of thing where you sell to the Boeings or the Microsoft
clients.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, sure, they like, I think, taking your dollars for your family plan for you and
my
like
$5 a month, you
45
mean?
Yeah. Members yeah. of your family. Okay, sure. But like what they really want is a corporation to say, hey,
yep.
we have a problem with passwords being on sticky notes or being 12345. What if we just pay 1Password to manage that stuff for us?
Here's 20 million bucks. Let every one of our employees use this.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because you let the IT admins be able to like, oh, I locked myself out. Okay. Well, we're going to unlock you. You know, send you the special code or, you know, other enterprise-y things of being able to reconnect you. It also disconnect you of like, oh, so-and-so got fired. All right, remove their access to the business 1Password so they can't do anything.
Right, yeah. I mean, yeah, and if you want to go back and listen to, I think it was two episodes ago on this show, Roustam talks about, in fact, I think the weekend that I met him was the weekend of Venice North 2014, and that was when the team decided to go into supplying businesses with 1Password product as you know, en masse, like you said. And that for them was a game changing weekend. So that's the beginning of it. And you know, obviously the family plan that I'm on, that Jaime's talking about, came out of that. And I think I pay, I want to say approximately $5 a month. I pay like annually, like I pay a fee once a year, but it gives me five seats, as it were, right? And that's obviously a lot smaller than a business plan, but still. I sleep well at night, and I know that my passwords are all pretty well safe, and I can access them anywhere I want, and so on and so forth. I guess we originally would have bought, I paid for the the 1Password app on my Mac, and then I also paid for the iOS version. I guess if you get 1Password now, do you get the apps for free if you subscribe, do you know? You're also a converter too, aren't you, Jaime?
Yeah, I've been on the subscription plan to sync things to all my devices through their services, and I think the app is free, and you pay for the subscription service.
Oh, okay.
I don't recall paying for the app when I got it. I think it had already switched to. It's really hard to call it a freemium model because it increasingly does less out of the box if you don't use their syncing service. Don't even recall if they offer still the Dropbox and then other models of syncing your stuff.
I did see some complaints recently on the Twitterverse about people who were legacy users, because as they move more towards their online subscription model, I think that's I'm beta testing the Password 8 right now, and it's much nicer than the 7.1. Rustin was right about that. He suggested I tried the beta. You can go to their site and I think what is early adopter. I'll put a link in the show notes here for if people are interested in trying it out. But it does work much better. And he's getting rid of that sort of. I think one of my complaints is I have my old legacy password, then I have the new subscription password, and so my newer machines I have to use the new password, whereas the old ones still use the legacy password. And I was complaining to him about that, and he sort of said, well, you know, when you get to the next version, it's going to be all the one password for everybody. You know, true to its name, as it were, right? So
good old Tim, you know, never met a edge case he didn't like.
Yeah,
Mitra,
right? I never met an edge case I liked, you mean? Yeah,
you should just, exactly. You know, charge a consulting fee of like, all right, I've got this incredibly complicated several decades plus setup, let's make sure that your QA is good. I'm gonna give you bug reports.
You know, it's funny you laugh about that, but it's like I'm actually a test case at the bank too, because because I've had my account for so long, my actual branch has moved 3 times, right? And in fact, my branch doesn't even exist anymore, right? So we were doing something, I think we had to do like you can go into the app and you can show me my direct deposit information, right? And we'll give you the transit number and the bank code and the account number and so on and so forth, right? In a PDF that you can share with people if they want to do like direct deposits or something like that, right? And because my branch moved, it didn't work for me, right? And I'm like, hey, what's up with this? And so we actually opened up a bug, and I was used as the guinea pig to test whether the feature was working properly. It goes back a few years, but yeah. So yeah, you laugh, but you know, if you've been around long enough, you've seen it all, right? And Mark and I have been around that long, and Jaime's catching up, as we said before. Alrighty. So this is a follow-up story too, that now we've talked about China and we talked about Asia. I think, what do we call it? BRIC? The Brazil, Russia, India. What's that thing called, Jaime?
And China.
China, yeah. Okay, BRIC. So, because for the longest time, you know, Android sort of ruled the roost over there in Asia and stuff like that, but partly because of the price of iPhones and stuff like that, it was the story, right? But this story here is that in the fourth quarter of last year, Reuters is reporting that Apple finally has grabbed market share in China, which is kind of a cool thing, I guess, sort of a milestone for them. And that's follow, as Greg says, eventually everything's follow up on this show. So the iPhone 13 was the tipping point for China, plus I think that the Huawei controversies, right?
It's kind of interesting to see what ends up happening with the handsets. Surely stuff like in the States, the Huawei stuff, previous presidential administration hurt their ability to, you know, losing access to one of the most lucrative markets in the world is going to hurt your ability to be powerful globally when it comes to your results. But that would not have applied in China itself. So it's interesting to see how Apple's brand sort of ebbs and flows within China itself, vis-a-vis other, you know, local Chinese brands, as well as Samsung, which is, you know, I think still global leader. Is that right? For handsets sold? I don't even actually know.
Probably. Yeah, I mean, let's look at the article here. I mean, it talks about, you know, Apple's market share reached 23%, a record for the brand, it says in the article here. And yeah, unit sales grew 32% year over year in the quarter. So,
although interesting, so total smartphone sales in China fell 9%.
Yeah. So,
So sales volume grew and market share grew, which means, yeah, for sure, means it's taking it away from someone, presumably Huawei.
Yeah.
The article does say the analyst cited a lower starting price in China and the impact of U.S. sanctions against Huawei. So It must, the sanctions, I guess, would probably be something in the supply chain. There's some parts or whatever that Huawei needs that then the U.S. sanctions are impacting that, I guess. Because as I said, it's sales here in this country wouldn't count against these numbers, you wouldn't think. So it must be some indirect thing. Don't know.
Yeah. So you know what that means, though, right? That means that if you haven't already added Chinese language localization into your app, you probably should think about doing it now, you know, because you're missing out on the market. So that's growing. Alrighty.
Well, and depends what your product is. I'm not sure TD Bank has too many customers in China.
You'd be surprised. Well, we don't have some. not in China specifically, but we do support Chinese language in our phones, in our apps. Yeah. I mean,
that could easily be for Canadian customers, though.
No, it definitely is for Canadian customers. Yeah. It's kind of silly not to have Chinese in your app these days. But I just meant like I actually have, I think, device trackers localized, and Two for Life was localized. So to support, you know, more than, like, I have definitely got at least one version of Chinese in one of my apps. And so I do see sales over there. That's why I was saying to people, if you haven't thought about it, now is the time. It's always the time to localize your app, actually. I shouldn't say that. And so I think last week we talked about this a bit on the show. We've been talking about this Pegasus exploit, forgot the name of the company now, in Israel, I want to say, that created that exploit with the spyware software. And so last week or so, Apple rolled out updates to iOS and macOS to cover off these zero-day patches, right, that they had to put in. Apparently, there's a memory bug called IO Mobile Frame Buffer that affects Monterey iPad OS and iOS. So if you hadn't, I think, Jaime, you were doing a PSA on this podcast last week, right? Telling people to get out there and update their phones and their devices, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you somehow still haven't, you really should, because these were scary, visit a link and you're toast sort of things. They weren't ones that required a whole bunch of exotic things to happen. They were pretty, pretty easy to run across. So definitely helps to go up. Man, it was frustrating updating macOS on work device, personal device, upgrading my iPhone, upgrading my iPad, updating my Apple Watch, just my HomePod. Everything decided that it needed an update. So thankfully working from home does make that a little bit easier. I can sort of multitask while I'm doing that, but it's still kind of a hassle.
Yeah, for sure. So it's 15.3 is the iOS, iPadOS version you want to look at. And I forget what it is, 12. Actually, I've got it on this Mac here because I finally got all my Macs. Yeah, 12.1 is the Monterey version you're looking at. And apparently it doesn't affect, I don't know, it doesn't seem to affect Big Sur or Catalina. So a surprise, because Apple usually rolls out security patches for older versions of OS as well at the same time. So, yeah. So it's saying here this bug was first disclosed to Apple by Fingerprint.js in November of 2021, and it was publicly disclosed January 14th, 2022. So pitter patter, get at her, get that stuff updated. Alrighty. And then I guess it's time of year to talk about the Taobao Index. We've talked about this several times on the show before, which is why, again, it's follow up. And this is sort of the popular languages that are out there We were watching the rise of Swift, you know, earlier on when we looked at this, you know, I guess, how is this? We're coming up on our 8th year, right? We've been at this for a while.
From 2014. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're 7.5 years in. So Swift was like obviously way down there. Objective-C isn't even on the list anymore, which is surprising. And well, not surprising.
Not in the 20. If you go to the 50, it ends up at number 24. So it just missed the cut.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, I didn't see the 50. Yeah, here. Yeah. Yeah. And then, and surprisingly, Python, Mark's favorite, is at the top, right? Kicking C's butt and Java's butt. Right?
Yeah. It's always a little bit questionable what these rankings mean, right? So this is the growth in rank in ratings, whatever that means. What does that mean?
It's the 10 friends of the guy who wrote the article, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Python actually, though, is, I'm not surprised it's moved up because a lot of back-end stuff now is on Python. And the days of the, you know, Python versus Ruby on Rails wars are long over, and Python won. And even hear about Java as much anymore on the back end. It's more, it's almost all Python from what I hear. Python and or JavaScript if you're doing Node.
Oh, I just want to point out that COBOL is just one spot behind Objective-C. Just putting it out there.
Yeah, no. Having the fact that JavaScript is number 7, I find that really surprising. That's pretty low.
Yeah, well,
that's below Visual Basic. I mean, what do these rankings really mean? that's the question.
Oh, you think JavaScript should be higher because of its ubiquity?
And other sorts of things that list these, I would expect. JavaScript, Python, and Java to be your top 3. So I'm a little surprised that and C++ are so high. Visual Basic would normally be fairly low, sort of subsumed into the C# world. So I don't know what's going on there, unless you know, something came out that like, hey, suddenly there's a ton of jobs to update the old Visual Basic stuff. Just like COBOL is going to hang around for a very long time, if only because of the banking industry. Lots of people still doing that stuff. So if only just to, hey, somebody understand how to patch this thing. Oh, by the way, we've got this multi-year project to replace it with, you know, pick your language, Rust, let's say.
And then assembly language is number 8. What's that all about?
I wonder if people are doing more IoT stuff. The new car smell sort of wore off of IoT for a couple of years there, but I think it's sort of settled into an area where people are figuring out the things it could be used for, and it's less hyped.
Right. Well, it's good to know that Swift is up 3 points from, it was at 13th position last year, now it's at 10th. So that's, you know, making grounds. I mean, okay, we're not going to take...
So these ratings, I actually clicked on the link that explains what the rankings mean, mm-hmm. and then I don't give a precise definition, but it's about mentions on search engines. So it's not about popularity. It's not about usage. It's about mentions in search engines. So if, for example, a language is really frustrating for people, so they have to search for answers to a lot of questions, that will actually make it go up on the list.
Well, that would explain why C is
so, there. Yeah. Yeah, and assembly language. Yeah. So yeah, I would say take all this with a grain of salt, a pretty healthy grain of salt.
All right. Cool. All righty. But there you go. Our annual look at or semi-annual, somewhat annual, biannual look at the Taiob Index. I don't think we talked about it last year. And this next story is kind of interesting. And I think we saw this at WWDC, if I'm not mistaken, this year, or was it last year? This year, maybe?
I forget whether it was this year or last year. It's been a while. Yeah. But if you remember, Apple announced kind of a cool sounding new product feature called Universal Control, which would allow you to use your Mac keyboard or mouse to work on your iPad. So if they're within range, you know, you could kind of zoom over with your trackpad and move the cursor, and it'll flip over to your iPad and start typing on your keyboard, and it'll show up on the iPad, which is kind of a cool thing.
It's kind of like an external monitor would do on a second monitor on your Mac. Right?
Well, it's actually interesting that you mentioned that, because it is different from Sidecar. It should not be confused with Sidecar, which was the earlier technology that has been around for a couple of years, where you could actually use your iPad as an external monitor for your Mac. So exactly what you were just describing would happen, except it's as if your Mac screen is extended onto the iPad. This is a little bit different. You're still running iPad OS. It's still an independent machine. Everything is separate, except that the keyboard and trackpad or mouse work.
I see what you're saying. Right.
So it's almost like it's like an automatic KVM switch that is just triggered by moving the cursor. So you move the cursor over, and it's like your KVM switch flips, and you're controlling the other device. But with your, you can just do it on your laptop keyboard. So this is kind of a cool thing. It's in beta now, so presumably we'll see it for real, fairly soon. Pretty cool. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm kind of excited to try it out.
Yeah, I think that KVMs do work like that too, right? Like, I think a friend of mine has a KVM where you move the cursor over and it'll jump over to the other device, whether it's like running Windows or Mac or whatever. Is that not correct?
Maybe there are some that do that. Yes. I haven't used a KVM in a while, but the last time I used one, actually, it was kind of a manual effort where you had to flick a physical switch.
Or something like that.
So, I wouldn't be surprised if they had something like that in a third party device, but you got to figure it's going to be much more seamless and smooth, on this experience because for no other reason that one of the sets of hardware are built into the machine you're actually working on. So
yeah, true.
Should be pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool. Like, I guess I can throw away my magic keyboard that I bought from my iPad now, but yeah,
well, it'll work with that. Cool. Potentially.
Actually,
I'm not sure. You're right. I'm not sure. I don't know whether it goes the other direction. If you can control your Mac with a magic keyboard, that's a good question. Probably.
Yeah.
Not.
But I'm actually using right now. I'm using a wireless magic trackpad, and I've got a wireless keyboard in front of me. So this is totally the equipment you would need, right?
Yep.
Once you get it. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. That is pretty awesome.
I think it is pretty interesting to use that sort of feature for a, you don't want to have a whole bunch of mice on your desk just to manage those devices. So it's kind of cool to have a software solution that will just like say, oh, it looks like there's a notification over there on my iPad. Let me go click on that instead of having to, like an animal, take my hands off the mouse and then go tap the notification. Yep. Just use my mouse. It's already in my hand. Why not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a case where a lot of times at work on a Zoom call, I'll be sharing my iPad to the Zoom call, as well as my Mac, because I'm on the call on the Mac, and then I share the iPad screen to demo things. So I'm constantly, without thinking about it, trying to use the Magic Trackpad to do something on my Mac, or use my Mac to do something on my iPad. So this would solve a lot of that problem, except for the fact that since I'm screen sharing, I'm actually seeing my iPad screen on my Mac. So I don't know what this is going to do to my brain. If I'm actually using my Mac keyboard to control my iPad, but seeing it on my Mac, I have no idea what'll happen here, but I want to try it.
Mm, cool.
Yeah. If you've ever used Google Meet to share, like your screen, and you don't flip over to like another tab, it will do that weird sort of infinite mirror sort of thing that does sort of mess with your brain a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Oh, yes. This is a new feature that came out this week. If you haven't heard about it, if you don't get email from Apple, I guess. Was this announced in email? I guess it wasn't. But Apple has now added support on the Apple Store for developers writing apps to publish an app with an unlisted URL. So that basically, I guess it means it won't show up in a search in the App Store?
I believe that is correct. I think you have to know the secret URL to get to there.
Right.
So this is kind of a useful thing for certain things. I could see for a lot of enterprise customers or really niche applications where this app is really only meant for people who are interested in a certain kind of thing or have a certain kind of account, and just having a lot of people just downloading randomly based on App Store search isn't going to help you in a lot of cases. So you could put it up there and specifically send the link to your target customers and have them use it. Kind of gets around some of these issues that people did where they were trying, they were misusing the enterprise program to send things to people. Some few big companies who had horrible earnings announcements today. Might have done that once in the past.
Wait, do I have to check my stock?
Do you have to check to know what I'm talking about? Yeah, we can talk about this later.
Maybe I do. Let's have a look.
Yeah, you won't really know about it till tomorrow when the market.
Okay. It's always a good time to buy when they have a bad report, right?
Maybe. I mean, bad reports. I mean, we're getting a little off topic here, but bad reports can mean that the stock will become undervalued, or it could mean that things are really bad. And, you know, catching a falling knife is never a good strategy in stocks, because a lot of times you get cut.
Okay.
Yep.
This is a good, I mean, I know of a number of times when people have built apps, like, you know, I know of companies, like, you know, if you have an app that is connected to a service, for example, and, you know, if you're not a subscriber to that server or a user of that service, I should say, there's no point in having the app, right? So, like you said, it could be like insurance companies or banks or that kind of thing, or like schools, like talking about higher education students, stuff like that. Conference attendees is an example. Like if you have a conference app or something like that, there's no point in putting it out there for people who aren't going to the conference to have at it, right? So I'm just reading here right off the Apple documentation, unlisted app distribution page here. Plus employee-owned devices here that aren't eligible. Some aren't eligible to be managed through the school manager or the business manager profiles that Apple has set up, right? So, cool. Oh, and also regions that all regions that are supported by the App Store. Not sure what that means, but anyway.
Yeah.
That's kind of a cool feature.
It is, because, like, you know, let's say you're the... you're Netflix, and there's a cafeteria app that you really want your employees to have, but you kind of don't want to go through the hassle, like, man, putting it through the enterprise distribution stuff. It's kind of a hassle. I kind of want to just look here, new hire, click this link, download this app, figure out how many burritos and, you know, donuts you want, and pre-order them. Having an unlisted app seems like it would be kind of a good case for that. And the special organization, special events thing, you can kind of do that with conferences too. That sort of sticks in my mind as something where you would, you kind of want the convenience of the App Store distribution without the sort of enterprise profile stuff, but don't necessarily want it, you know, for everyone to use and look at. It is something that Apple is going to obviously look very closely at and make sure you're not doing anything untoward. This is not the loophole for you to do, you know, whatever terrible, seedy, illegal, or immoral things. It's still Apple. They're still reviewing. This isn't a free-for-all. So keep that in mind.
Well, I mean, it also seems like, it seems to me that, and I've talked to people who use the enterprise softwares, and because they're on the enterprise program, they don't have the same scrutiny, like you said. Like, they're able to sort of go outside of the sort of realm of regular sort of app creation to create features and stuff like that, because they're not under that same review process, right? Because presumably it's used by a smaller group, like an enterprise, which is, you know, admittedly not small, but still. I have talked to developers on enterprise teams that have said, we don't have to worry about that stuff, you know, like whatever issue du jour we're complaining about as developers is, right? So, cool. And then, Jaime, you got to hear a story on iCloud, which makes me worried, because I was looking up some stuff on my Notes app the other day and I couldn't find it.
Yeah, this is apparently, according to this article here, iCloud syncing issues are plaguing third-party apps. And there's definitely tons of apps you would know of who have had complaints and have published dedicated support articles or tweeted about it, or doing things like disabling iCloud syncing by default. So GoodNotes, TapBots, and Mr. James Thompson for pCalc have tried to avoid the, you know, customer support mess of whatever weird iCloud syncing of user data problems that have been plaguing things. There is a developer forum link, a thread in developer forums. Hopefully this gets solved real soon, because it's, you know, it's an area where you kind of want it to just work, right? You don't want to be wondering where the heck is this file. Where's this data? That's one of the things that way back in the olden days we talked about iCloud core data syncing. Was that, what was the old name?
Yeah, it was It was Core Data, iCloud Core Data or something.
Yeah, like what was the, I think it might have just been iCloud Core Data. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so.
As opposed to now it's Cloud Core.
Yeah, CloudKit.
CloudKit Core Data, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, subtle difference.
Totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the early one was a mess. I've always heard good things about the later one until this recent thing. It's kind of a shame.
Yeah, and yeah. Hopefully that's something that could be fixed server-side, ideally, so that you don't have to have a release of iOS and macOS itself go out to resolve this.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, or ship a new version of your app. That would be a pain, too.
Oh, man, yeah. If you got to use the new API or something.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of apps that use, like I use a ton of apps that use iCloud to not, and I don't think they're necessarily using Core Data in the back end. They may be, I don't know. But, and I've noticed recently, like my timer app on my Intel machine has stopped working, and I've been using it for years and years and years. But yeah, that's an example of a weirdness that I noticed recently, but I wasn't sure if that was related to this or not, right?
Yeah, so consider this your public service announcement that if you've been bashing your head on the keyboard wondering, what am I doing wrong? You might not be doing anything wrong. It might just be the underlying platform is doing bad things.
Of course, you'll get blamed for it, unfortunately, but
yeah,
but you can at least take solace.
As a developer, you mean? Or?
As a developer, right. By the users, the app users.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that one and see where we go, right? Yep.
Breezy, we didn't talk about some of the, things that people might be thinking about, and possibly by the time this episode goes out, might actually be live, like using Face ID with a mask on as we sit here. On February 2022, the pandemic is still going on. If you're lucky enough to use an Apple Watch like I do, you've been able to unlock your device with Face ID. If you flick the little switch that says, use my watch as the other way to verify me. But this, as I understand it, means that people who don't have Apple Watches can take it, part in this fun in unlocking devices. And even better, they can use Face ID for things like Apple Pay or unlocking apps, right? This only got you into the device itself previously. The latest update in, I think, the same beta we were talking about as the Face ID upgrade for face masks. So,
yeah, 15.4, nice. I think, right?
I think it is. I think it's 15.4 beta, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think people were already posting to Twitter about it, right? So,
yeah, so that'll be a nice quality of life thing. It feels like it will continue to be useful, but I'm holding out hope that it will be not very useful soon.
Right. Let's hope.
I want this to be a big waste of time, ideally.
Like the hand washing app? Yeah, yeah.
As we're rounding the bases on year two of the pandemic.
Well, there's also a rumor. We were talking a couple of weeks ago about, isn't there a rumor about a new iPad coming recently? Or, supposedly an event that's coming up soon?
Yeah, people are thinking there's a March event coming up. As we sit here, there is nothing yet announced, and given it will almost likely be virtual, and reporters don't have to, fly in to Cupertino. They can just tell you, hey, tomorrow, we're gonna drop some new stuff and check it out. And people will just have to click the links and watch. So we may not find out for, almost a good month now, from now.
Is that going to be like a new iPhone? Some sort of iPhone and iPad event?
I think people were saying new iPads, Pro models, I think, and some revision to the iPhone SE. I'm a little out of date on the rumor.
Oh,
mill.
The SE, right. Yeah, yeah.
So more M1 Max or iPads, maybe?
I think.
M1 Pro.
Yeah.
With 32 gigs of RAM, 64 gigs of RAM, and 10 cores, and it levitates off the desk when you're using it.
So one other new thing we haven't talked about before we get into the picks is, what do you guys think of the new and improved and slightly friendlier App Store review process?
I haven't really used it, but why don't you tell us about it, Mark?
So it's mainly the process. It's not really anything new about how the reviews work, but the biggest new thing, well, other than the fact that you get nice friendly emails whenever you do something now. It's like, hey, thanks for submitting this app. The biggest thing is that you can now submit multiple builds at the same time. which is really kind of a change. That's something we never had before. There was always this issue of, you know, say you submit your build, it gets approved, but you already have another build ready, and you kind of don't want to release the first one because you might have some special event coming up. You'd rather have the next one in. So there's this roll of the dice you have to do of, okay, you have to remove the other one from approval and put the new one in, and then you're back in this waiting for review and review cycle, and then it's always a little bit of you know, nail biting until it actually gets approved. Things have gotten better now that they've pulled in the review times by quite a bit, but you know, you still never know what's going to go wrong. Well, now they've gotten rid of that. You can actually have, as I said, two different builds, or more than one build, I guess, more than two even, at the same time, in review at the same time. So you can in theory stage releases. I haven't actually done it yet, so I don't know how well it works in practice. But it seems like it could be a really useful thing. I mean, you could put an app in for review, and while it's being reviewed, you get another follow up version in. So you never have this even 1 minute of not having something available that you could release at any given time once the approval starts. Cycle starts going through.
Oh, okay. I see what the difference is. Like, so, because we've done that before. We've had multiple, like, you know, we upload a build, we send it to test flight, and then we upload another build, and we test that one.
It's in test flight, right? But you can't submit. Yeah, for it. but it's not
on the store. Right. Gotcha. So you can't have two, like, in the queue ready to be released, sort of idea.
That
the
right. Idea? That's right. That's right. So you can have. The classic case that I can think of is what I sort of just mentioned, but I'll elaborate a little bit more, is say you have in 2 weeks, you have a huge event where you want to have your app ready for that event. And so you submit good practice, you submit a few weeks in advance, but you're still working on the app to get those last few features or last few bugs fixed or whatever. Right. But you want to get one in, so just in case you have something available that you can release if you need to. And that one gets released, and you're great, and you're ready to go with that previous one. But now you've got this new one that has extra features, bugs fixed or whatever. And I guess I'm talking about sort of a specific case where this is a brand new app where you haven't released it ever yet. So you don't want to release that first version, that first approved version. You'd rather release the second version, but it hasn't been approved yet. So in the old days, you would have to remove the first one from approval. And then you're in this kind of waiting period where you've got nothing available that's been approved that you could possibly release until the second one gets approved. Now you don't have to do that anymore. Maybe this doesn't come up often because it's mostly with new apps, but it feels like I've been in this situation multiple times in my career. So I feel like this will be a pretty useful thing.
Cool.
Yeah.
So since we're talking about iOS 15.4 and things that are coming out, did you know, Mark, you're going to be so excited by this. There's new emojis coming as well.
I heard. Yeah. Can't wait.
The one where you're going to poke in the eye.
Right.
The gut busting burrito man with a large distended stomach. People have called that pregnant man, but, you know, I go with ate too many burritos, man.
Guess gut busted what?
You haven't seen that emoji? It's like like the pregnant woman emoji.
Pregnant man. Pregnant man. Yeah.
It's got the pregnant man here. The male face. And so I'm like, oh, that's kind of an interesting one.
Yeah, there's like melting face. There's palm up hand, palm down hand, leftward hand, rightward hand, index pointing at the viewer hand. Heart hands, which is a very important one. Biting lip. Person with crown. Interesting. Troll. You can have a troll now in your post. Mirror balls. Yeah, bubbles. X-ray. Cool. All right. Yeah, and there's text scanning with notes and reminders. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because you can do that now with... I guess they're using the photo app to do that. Because you know how I don't know if you guys have been using it, but I love this new feature in the phone with the photo app where you can take a picture and... you can select a text that's in the picture. That was a feature that they talked about in the WWDC, but I've been using it a lot. It's not always 100% accurate, but it's, you know, if you ever need to write a serial number down or something like that, it's super helpful, especially on those tiny ones on the bottom of your Macs. All right. Let's move on to our pick. So Mark was asking about my post here because it says, all it says is I won. And it actually comes back from a Twitter post that, let's see here, open link, that Carla, not a robot, posted, said, my team had a debate on what the best looping variable name is, and I won. No?
This is where if we had better production values, we would have the, you know, high quality Dolby Atmos rim shot of the drums going on right now. With a THX kind of approval quality thing, but yeah.
Well, I do have a digital drum kit here. I can do a rim shot for you if you like. Yeah. Yes, I won. The lowercase letter I won. It's a joke. Okay, moving on. Jaime, do you have a pick?
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the Tioga Index and Objective-C being, what did I say, 24 on their list. Timely here for an article that is now almost 5 years old, but it's a short history of Objective-C, which ended up on my list at some point. I don't know how I ended up seeing this, probably on Twitter or something, but I actually learned. I had always believed that Next Step was the originator of Objective-C, but it says, no.
Oh, did you? Oh.
Apparently not. No, there were some predecessor steps leading up to that. Yep. Yeah. So today I learned.
It's funny in here he talks about, you know, the fact that I read part of this article and he says that, you know, he had a hard time finding the history of Objective-C. But ironically, I used to teach iOS development in 2011, 2012, and I used to talk about the origins of Objective-C and how it was the language that the people at Next used on their systems to write their software. But yeah, it comes out of... Smalltalk was initially there, and then the two guys, is it Brad, what are their names again? Brad Cox, I want to say, and something Love.
Tom Love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were basically work, and they liked what Smalltalk did, but it was a little slow, and it was also owned by Xerox at the time, I think. And so they wanted to do something similar, and they were looking at C, and C didn't have this object-orientated idea that the original Smalltalk, whose name is Mark, help me here.
Smalltalk? What about it?
Who invented it? Who was the guy who wrote it?
Oh,
says here Alan Kay's
team. Alan Kay?
Yeah, at Xerox Spark.
So they liked the idea of writing in objects as opposed to... we used to write code in procedural. If you've ever written PHP in the early days, that's how you wrote stuff. The idea of using objects, and so they objectified C, basically, right? So they took the C language and wrapped it in objects and stuff, and that's how Objective-C got its name as well, right? So, cool.
Yeah, the middle step there of the, what did they call it, the object-oriented precompiler as being a sort of predecessor to that is interesting. And again, I apparently knew some of the steps of like, oh, okay, it certainly became pretty popular because of Next Step and being brought into Apple through that acquisition. So I just kind of didn't know the history and assumed it had originated at Next Step. And I was pretty interested in the, you know, when I figured out like, coming into iOS development for the first time and looking at Objective-C, it's just so strange and weird looking for newbies. If you're coming from other C-based languages, like C, C++, or maybe something like Java. And I remember it sort of not really clicking at the time until I had seen something that said, oh, it's like Smalltalk. I'm like, oh, it totally is Smalltalk. Now I understand the syntax. The syntax suddenly, the epiphany shattered through all of the sort of barriers I had in my brain. So seeing that it was, you know, not just Smalltalk-ish in the way that it's, you know, actual syntax work, but that they had looked at Smalltalk and liked things about it and said, what if we made a better or at least, you know, more refined version of Smalltalk in the ways that they wanted? That's kind of cool to see. It kind of closes the loop on some of the things that I've sort of tacitly known, but apparently didn't have the full picture of before.
Yeah. And it's interesting that people don't realize it, but Java and Objective-C both have, they come from the same branch or the same tree, right? So
C++.
Yeah, but they're all based on C, right? Like they're all C-based languages.
Java
right?
is not C-based.
Isn't it? Oh.
No. I mean, it shares a lot of syntax with C, but it is not C-based. But Objective-C and C++ both are.
C++, yeah. Okay, that's something of the Windows and versus Mac kind of idea, right?
And C# is not regardless of the name, C# is not a C based language. Interestingly enough,
All right, cool. Yeah, it's always interesting to see where that stuff comes. And Mike, you got a link here as well.
Yeah, so I read the article, really enjoyed that article as well, and was motivated to look up something they mentioned in that first article, which was the original Byte magazine story on Smalltalk, which is what the founders of Objective-C saw and were intrigued by and used to model Objective-C on. So I figured I would see if I could look it up online. And for those of you who don't know, they used to actually have whole magazines about computers. You know, they were actually printed on paper.
Before the internet.
Yeah, you'd get it in the mail every week. Hundreds of pages of ads about
computers. It's how more than just code started, wasn't it? Wasn't it a magazine initially?
Was it?
No.
Okay.
It could have been.
Yeah, anyway. So back in the 80s, there was a magazine called Byte, B-Y-T-E, which was kind of the premier computer magazine. Everybody read Byte, and it was, you know, back in the days it was a much smaller industry, smaller community, so everyone reading the same magazine kind of made sense, as opposed to these days where there's a bazillion different websites for whatever in particular you like. So Byte did, my impression was that Byte did a story on Smalltalk in this issue. So I went and looked it up. It turns out it's even better than that. Almost the entire issue of the magazine, which is 500 pages long, by the way, they must have done that every month, is devoted to Smalltalk. There's probably a dozen articles about Smalltalk or about object-oriented programming in general in this magazine. Wow. Now, I have to admit, I just looked at this today, so I haven't read most of the articles, but it looks like if you're interested in a kind of a historical view of what things were like 40 years ago, it would be a really interesting read. Probably from a technical point of view, everything's very dated now, but you know, just some of the early articles on what is object-oriented programming all about. You know, they had to introduce object-oriented programming, which is kind of an amazing concept, but they did. So it's really interesting. It's really worth looking up, but we've got the link in the notes. But I have to say, my favorite part was actually not the articles, looking at all the old ads.
Ads
from 40 years ago. Yeah. They've got ads for the Apple II. They've got ads for the Atari 800. They've got ads for the TRS-80. There's a full two-page spread advertising Pan Am Airlines. Do you remember Pan Am? That's an airline that hasn't existed for a long, long time. But two things in there that I saw that just made me laugh aloud article or ads. One ad was for a company advertising software that you only have to, you write your software once and it works on all the different platforms. It works on the 6502, it works on the 8080, works wherever you want. Going to change the world. You'll only have to write your
Is
software
called
once.
Basic?
No. It was something it doesn't exist. You've never heard of it. But just the idea that, you know, even 40 years ago, people were talking about that stuff and we're still not there and probably will never be there. But next time someone comes and says, oh, we have to do this because it'll change everything, look up this ad. Anyway, the second one was actually even funnier, because it was someone was selling some software called The Last One. And the last what? Well, it's the last piece of software you'll ever have to buy, because this software writes other software. And you just give it some commands in simple English, and it goes and writes the software for you. You never have to write software again.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. This is from the August 1981 issue of Byte magazine. It's worth checking out just to see, you know, what it was like back then. I remember those days vaguely.
Yeah, like you can buy an Apple II computer for $1,000, and if you want to buy a disk drive, that's $500.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, for that. 20 megabyte disk drive, if you're lucky, right?
Yeah.
Hard disk drive. Oh, they're probably even talking, they're just talking about the floppy drive, probably.
Yeah. The 5 1/4.
Not even the hard drive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
And, you know, different Hayes modems, I remember those things, and getting expansion cards for your for your computers, your Apple IIs, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
And these,
do it yourself. Build your own Z80 computer, Mark.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have those in this country. We had Z80, but it was. I think it was very similar.
Yeah. We had Z80 in Canada. You
guys, Yeah.
Z80.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they even advertised you can get the 16K version of your Apple II or the 32K version of your Apple II. That's RAM. That's total RAM. K, not meg. K.
Right. Yeah.
Funny. Funny days. The old days. Anyway. Check it out. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. And not all of this copy would have been set by hand too, because they don't think they had typesetting at that point. Well, no, I guess they had typesetting, but they didn't. Yeah. This would have been laid out by hand. This is way before desktop publishing even, right?
Yeah. And it's 500 pages long. That's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they would have run that many ads to get paid for it, right?
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
This would have been the magazine to be in if you were in that industry too, right?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Inside the back cover ad would have been, or back cover ad would have been a big one. And then inside the back cover would have been another good spot to have.
Yeah. There was Byte. There was Compute. I don't remember if it was later. Might have been later.
Yeah.
What else was there? There was Popular Computing.
But you used to get programs out of this too, right? You used to, they would people publish the code that way.
Oh yeah. There are programs in this issue. So if you happen to have a TRS-80 lying around, there's some programs just for you in this issue.
Here's a controversial article. Is the Smalltalk 80 system for children?
Yeah.
Right. Cool.
Here's one. Okay, let's see. Programming quickies. What have we got this month? We've got Boss, a debugging utility for the TRS-80 Model 1. What else we got? We've got a software review of Microsoft Editor Assembler Plus. We've got a cartoon about computer shopping where somebody actually brings their computer to the supermarket with them. Crazy computer shopping. Where did they plug it
in? Yeah. Why would you ever need a computer at the grocery store? It's insane.
Yeah.
For your list, because you can't print it out because you couldn't afford a printer.
We've got something, another program for your TRS-80. That seems to be the popular one here. Called a disk catalog for the 80s. Bunch of basic code. The first line of the code is go sub 500. Anyway, if you remember basic, you'll laugh at that because it was, whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, that's enough. Check that out if you're interested in this stuff.
The usage of terminology, even just right there, which what I think is the when you click the link, I got the second page, I think. I guess it's technically the third page on Chromix. Chromemco's outstanding Unix-like operating system. Just seeing how they describe some things, like the very last heading is the standard OS for the future with a hyphen in between.
Yeah.
So they hadn't decided that OS would be recognizable enough as just, two capitalized letters next to each other.
And the paragraph above, C compiler available too, with C in quotes.
It's interesting to be like, I guess we got one of those too. File system, we have a file system. I was like, oh, cool. With hierarchical directories and protected files. So interesting to see. And they had called out Unix, and then they had to put the little cross that says, Unix is a trademark of Bell Telephone Laboratories.
Mm.
Long, long time since hearing some of this stuff. So I'm not familiar with Chromemco.
I'm not either. Oh, but I know precisely where they were located. That's funny.
I was going to say,
280 Bernardo Ave, Mountain View, California. If I'm not mistaken, I used to work right there. I wonder if it was even the same building. Let me look on the map. That's pretty funny. Obviously, it wasn't called Chromemco, and it was. I'm sure it wasn't even the same building, but it might have been the same spot. Let me see.
It is a corporate office. So it didn't become like a Jamba Juice or something.
Hmm.
Yeah. Not that far away from Boston Properties and Panasonic. That is funny.
I worked in that precise building.
Oh, there you go.
At that address, at least. I don't know if it's the same building at the time. It probably wasn't. Well, it might have been. This was 1981. It could have been. Yeah, when I worked at a company called Synopsys, I worked at that address, that exact address. How funny. That's a weird coincidence, isn't it? That just this random ad, random page that you called out.
That is serendipity, Mark.
Yeah.
Serendipity.
Yep. Yep. Anyway.
Cool. Nice. It's cool. Cool looking through these kind of. I like to get these actual physical magazines and go through them. Mm. We have tons of these old kind of things at our house. Mm-hmm. All righty. Yeah, it brings us around to what I've been up to last week. So, have we talked about Grid Studio at all on this podcast?
I don't think so. I don't recognize this Grid Studio.
Okay, so I have beside me a iPhone 4 that has been taken apart and mounted. And, you know, labeled all the bits and pieces like that. So this company called Grid Studio, they're Chinese, and they basically sell old technology. We got focused in on this because of iPhones. You can buy like an iPhone, original iPhone 1 mounted like in a frame, right? They take it apart, they clean it up. They don't put the batteries in, obviously. They put in like a fake battery. But they just, it's like a take apart kind of diagram of your phone. And, those are like $500-$600 and those sell out like in a second. So once you find out that they're available, they go quick. So I've got a ton of phones here too. And of course, I've obviously got the skills too. So I'm probably going to just take my own iPhone 1 apart and mount it this way. Cause you know, barely runs as it is. And I've got my iPhone 3 just happened to die. Again, the battery exploded a couple of weeks ago. So I'm going to mount that one too. But yeah, so if you're looking for a really sort of cool keepsake of this era, check out this link you've got here in the show notes to Grid Studio and check out the sales. I bought a little, acrylic, like mounted A7 chip as well. The A7 is, I think that's the first Apple Silicon, right? So check it out. Check this out. So and then another thing. Go ahead.
Does it come with the hardware or do you put your own hardware in?
No. It comes like you basically buy, they source the phones. They won't take your phone and do it. They won't take your phone and put it together. But I'm thinking about doing it myself. Like I'm going to take my phone apart and mount it myself because I got the graphic skills to do that, right? Mm-hmm. There's also somebody on Etsy that does a similar thing as well, where they take apart phones and that one, the one on the listing on Etsy will take your phone and I think it's about $300 to get them to take your phone apart and mount it for you, right? So it's kind of a cool thing. Like if you're collecting, but you can also get like Nintendo Game Boy stuff. You can get game controllers, they'll do. I have a BlackBerry I could take apart. That'd be kind of cool. But it's kind of like if you clicked on the link there, you'll see all the way they sort of mount them, right? So I bought this just before Christmas, and it arrived. It's really well packaged. I mean, like I gotta say, like really well done. So you can see the 4S or 4 that I bought. Yeah, Game Boy they've got here on the link here. And yeah, if you look at the Grid, they call it Grid One. That one's the original iPhone. It's always sold out. So like I said, I'm going to take mine apart and mount it. But yeah, you can get like Game Boys and stuff like that. These are obviously, things that are no longer working, right? Yeah, check it out. You can join the mailing list and they'll notify you when the iPhone 1 comes out if you're interested in mounting a phone on your wall for Apple nostalgia. And away you go. So the other thing too is, I've talked about neuroplasticity and since I did a talk and an article a couple of years ago about, how you learn things and using neuroplasticity, I kind of like hack my own skills, right? So over the last, couple of years, I've taught myself how to touch type by using these techniques of using short, bursts of practice and skills and that kind of stuff. And so I bought at Boxing Day a keyboard and got this app called Melodix. I just, it was an ad. I can't remember how I saw it. It came in my email box or came on, showed up in Facebook or something like that. And I kind of was intrigued by it. What it is very similar to, I don't know if you guys have played or heard of Rock Band on PlayStation. It's a game where it's you plug your actual guitar into it. Very similar to how Rock Band or what was that iPhone game that came out before where you tap Revolution. Remember that game?
Yep.
Where you see like those little icons move down the screen and you tap the screen when they cross a line, for instance. So it uses that methodology to teach you how to play piano, right? So you're looking, you have your, in front, so you get an actual MIDI keyboard, you plug it into your Mac or your iPad, And it takes you through and it teaches you how to build muscle memory to learn how to play a keyboard with your right hand and left hand and kind of thing, and to play in tempo and play on time, and you know, and you learn different scales and that kind of stuff as well as you go. I've been doing it for like, I think I hit 40 or 50 days that I've been doing it so far. And yeah, it's amazing. I'm actually working on arpeggios right now, which are really tough. But yeah, so I'm teaching myself how to play piano, and it's like 5 minutes a day, like no more than that. Surprisingly, Gibson has also come up with a guitar app that does very similar thing. I've been playing guitar for, I don't know, I bought my first guitar in university, so it would have been like 35 years ago, maybe. So I've been playing guitar for 35 years. I play with my bare hands. I have long fingernails, and I finger pick my guitar, and you know, I strum with my thumb and that kind of stuff. But I've never really mastered playing with a pick. So I've been using this Gibson app to teach myself how to play guitar with a pick. Admittedly, I've already got skills to play guitar, so I'm going through. I have to go through the beginner levels, which is kind of annoying. But it's the same model where you on your phone or your iPad, the notes, you know, move across the screen, and you strum or you pick the string, and it shows you, you know, it teaches you which fingers to use. Now, what's interesting about the keyboard thing is I taught myself how to play piano years and years ago when I was a kid, but never really properly. And so what this app does is not only teaches you how to, and both of them do, the Gibson app on the guitar and the piano app teaches you which finger to use, which is kind of interesting too, because like naturally I would sort of use my index and my thumb. But in this case here, like touch typing, you learn to use your middle finger or your baby finger depending on what you're playing, right? So like an arpeggio is thumb, middle finger, baby finger, thumb sort of thing, and you just go back and forth. And as well, also, I don't know if I may have mentioned this before, but at the beginning of COVID, because I can't play with my band because we couldn't get together and jam, I bought myself a digital drum set. And the Melodix app also works with drums. So you can, if you want to learn how to play drums, the Melodix app is kind of cool for that too. So anyway, I know it's an app pick, not necessarily technology, but it is using brain science. It is to teach you like sort of like the way Duolingo and those kind of things work, to teach you in little bits at a time how to build muscle memory and learn skills, learn to read music, that kind of stuff as well at the same time. So those are my picks for today. Questions? No?
Tim, have I ever told you about the Positive Grid Spark practice amp?
Noah?
Okay. I will save that for next time.
Okay. Positive, yeah. What's it called?
Positive Grid is the company. It's the Spark practice amp. Yeah, I'll tell you about it next time.
You can tell me about
it. That's not for cliffhanger.
Yeah. Yeah, We'll put it in your picks. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Mark, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
MarkR@smapsoft.com. And I don't know if you noticed, but the way you said, hey, Mark, sounded like it was from that movie. Oh, hi, Mark. Anyway, you know another reference? Never mind.
No.
I mean, do you know what I'm talking about?
No, which...
All right, do your thing, and then I'll look it up. Well, wait.
This is totally staying in the show. And Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
All right, and as usual, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra, on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC, and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
So there was this movie, which I've never seen, called The Room.
Which the Tommy Wiseau movie?
Yeah, universally considered the worst movie ever. But there was a documentary about the making of The Room, which people actually like, about, you know, the making of the worst movie ever. And anyway, there's a scene in the movie where the horrible, the guy who is portrayed as being a horrible actor, how about that, comes in and he says, "Oh, hi, Mark." And it's become like a meme. So that's what I was referring to.
Seen any good episodes of Boba Fett recently?
I haven't actually seen today's, so I gotta catch up.
My two word review, three word review of it, it's old home week on Boba Fett. I'll save that for tomorrow, but you'll know it, you'll get it when you see it.
Did Luke Skywalker show up again?
I'm not gonna give it away. You can't force me to ruin it for you. Have you watched it yet, Mark?
No, but I watched Mandalorian. Right. Finally, that's how I know Luke Skywalker.
The last episode of Boba Fett was pretty much, it was the return of the Mandalorian. It was the actor who plays Boba Fett wasn't even on the episode.
Just the recap.
And he gets top credit, right? Like he's the top guy, right?
It's wild. They've definitely got this set up so that they can get you to watch all the series, right?
Yeah,
you can't just I don't want to see that one. No, you kind of have to if you want to see the rest of this story.
They're trying to do the Marvel Universe thing where there's enough of a little tie-in that it hooks you in to see the next movie.
Mm.
Yep. Yeah. Wow. The Washington football team in the NFL has an official name now.
Yeah.
The Commanders.
What do you think of the name?
It's kind of odd name because... Yeah. Everybody immediately said the Commies, especially because they're red and gold for their colors.
Right.
But looking at their Reddit, their fan base is sort of split. Some people don't like it. They want it Red Wolves or some other thing. And some people are like going full on. There's various pictures of Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington football team, in like a Mao Zedong or USSR Soviet propaganda style stuff. So, You'll definitely have some fun looking at the memes for this one for a while.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if this will last. They could change it again in a couple of years. It just doesn't, I don't know. Who wants to say Washington Commanders? It doesn't roll off the tongue.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see I don't think I've seen a mascot yet. Just the new kit.
And how are they going to abbreviate it? I mean, the Commies? No, they can't use that, obviously. The Comms? The Wash Comms? And it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you like in the Super Bowl, honey?
Mm.
For you Canadians, you know what the Super Bowl is, Tim?
Yeah, it's sort of like a sport event where you guys kick a ball around.
It's kind of like rugby.
Guy sings in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's kind of like rugby.
Kind of like rugby? Well, we don't play rugby up here. But
you don't play rugby?
We do. We have this thing called Canadian football.
Oh, that's right. You do.
Three downs on 115 yards.
Right.
So the
right.
field is longer and you have less downs to complete the same amount of work, you know? Hmm. So,
it's,
the one who can chug the most maple syrup wins.
Hard to choose between the Cincinnati Bengals and the LA Rams. Neither team looked like world beaters in their championship, conference championship games. So I'm trying to look back and see the Rams are pretty stacked when it comes to their wide receiving core.
Yeah.
The Bengals with Joe Burrow, the young quarterback, just find a way to win. So I'm almost thinking a Bengals win, but I haven't seen the Las Vegas line.
I think Matt Stafford is hungry after all those years of being on mediocre teams. He's hungry. He's ready. So I'm going to pick the Rams.
Hmm.
Let's see, what is the Vegas line? Am I looking at the official thing here? Rams are a 4-point favorite, or they opened as a 4-point favorite.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it takes place at SoFi. They got the home stadium too. Game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. Yep. Okay, that's going to be hard to beat. Get to sleep in your own bed.
They're the home team.
So
usually the Super Bowl is played at just a predetermined site. Every year, and it's picked a few years in advance. But every once in a while, it just so happens that the team, one of the teams that goes to the Super Bowl, is the home team for that stadium. And this year it happens to be that way. Happened a couple of years ago too in Tampa too when the Bucks went. But it's not. It doesn't happen too often. Pretty uncommon.
Yeah, they're determined well in advance. This article does not have the thing I wanted to see. Oh, there it is. SoFi Stadium is this year. Next year is State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona, where the Cardinals play. After that, in 2024, is Allegiant Stadium, where Las Vegas, the Raiders play. And then 2025, the Caesars Superdome in Nolens, where the Saints play.
Nolens?
New Orleans, Nolens.
Nolens? Yeah, Nolens, thinking.
And they're generally in warm weather or domed stadiums, yeah, with the rare exception when they did Detroit and New York, which were pretty controversial at the time of, like, is this a bad idea or not? You don't normally want to risk heavy snowstorms in New York or in
they wouldn't in do it in Green Bay. That wouldn't make a lot of sense. Green Bay or Minnesota, somewhere like that. Actually, Minnesota's a dome, isn't it?
So, Mark, somebody posted Zuckerberg saw his shadow.
Oh. He saw somebody's shadow sneaking up on him today.
Yeah.
Wall Street's. Yeah. Yeah, they were down 20% after hours.
He saw that privacy protection shadow. That's what the iPhone privacy protection
thing. Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's Tim Cook's shadow. Yeah, I mean, this whole metaverse rename, it's kind of silly. They're just, doesn't seem like things are going well over there. But what do I know?
No? I don't know. I'm still up like 70% on their stock.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I bought it. I bought on day one, though, right? So when everybody said you're a fool to buy on day one, I had a few shares. I sold them when things got bad and we were not supposed to hold them anymore. So I sold it and bought Apple stock instead with the money. So got some free Apple stock from Facebook. So I can't complain.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. So they're sitting at 323, down off their peak from 2021 of about 370.
They closed at 323 today, but that was before the bad announcement. So in after hours, they dropped to like 250.
Wow.
So what was the announcement that they had a poor quarter or something, or what?
Yeah, I mean they're getting killed by the privacy stuff in iOS 14.
Oh, I see.
In after hours they're at 249, but you know who knows what it'll be. We'll see what it is tomorrow. So Facebook shares plunge more than 20% on weak earnings, big forecast miss. Revenue in the first quarter will be between $27 billion and $29 billion, while analysts were looking for that number to top $30 billion. That's pretty bad.
It doesn't mean like they're going to go out of business, though.
What's up?
It doesn't mean they're going to go out of business, though, right?
No, they're not going to go out of business. No, of course not.
Puts a cap on things. Imagine if you had, you know, $100,000 worth of then $100,000 worth of stock that you just signed on as a brand new fresh employee, then you have this happen, and how big of a chunk of that $100,000 does that take right out of your pocket? That's a consideration for longevity when it comes to being able to retain and recruit talent. So definitely not a thing you want to see. Google parent Alphabet is up, and they're doing a 20-for-1 stock split. So instead of 2,900, it'll be significantly less.
Oh, is that today as well, Google announcement?
Yeah, so it looks like there'll be $148 per share after the split, roughly.
That might be worth buying just on the psychology of it. You know, people, of course, when a stock splits, it really has no effect on the value of the company, right? But people have this conception that it does. So a lot of times the stock will go up after because all of a sudden it's much cheaper. People think it's lower priced, and so they buy the stock. Purely it's psychological because it's not a real effect. Just put the stock at zero effect on the valuation of the company. But people don't understand that. A lot of people don't, for some reason, don't understand market cap. They just think of price, and price is not really the important factor.
I haven't read the reasons for it. Generally, people do the split when they want to attract a different kind of investor. It's pretty pricey to get in at almost $3,000 a share. So hypothetically, you have more average investors.
It is true. There is an effect in some sense on You can increase demand when the price is lower because more people will want it because they can afford it. But it also increases supply. So yeah, mm-hmm. it's, I don't know. It, yeah.
Amazon sitting at around 3,000 per share. Interesting that they have not split. I wonder if they'll ever split or if they've gone with a different approach of like, no, we want a very particular kind of investor who can afford to pony up.
In the old days, that made some sense because in the old days, if you want to buy stock, you have to call your broker and buy a lot of 100 shares at whatever price it is. And you know, if it's $3,000 times 100, that's a lot of money. But these days, you just go online, go to on E-Trade or whatever, and buy, or Robinhood, and buy 0.1 shares if you want. So the price really means less. You can buy less than a share now.
Fractional share investing kind of an interesting thing that people are doing. There's a bank, I can't remember their name off the top of my head, just announced a new, actually, I don't know, I assume it's a credit card. I assume it's a rewards credit card, but could be a debit card. Nevertheless, they've announced a new card product that's in partnership with a company called Bumped out of Portland, Oregon, and they do fractional share investing. So I think the idea is, swipe at Target, swipe at Starbucks, McDonald's, Nike, wherever, and you'll get fractional shares of those companies. Hmm. So you can absolutely own micro fractional pieces of stock.
Really? Well,
yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. No more old fashioned stock certificates. It's all digital, all infinitely divisible.
Yeah, you won't find locked in a trunk in your grandmother's attic the original one share of IBM that she bought 50 years ago that's now worth more than your house. Right, those days are gone.
Right.
There was a movie. Gosh, what's the name of that movie? The basic plot was like there was like an old man, right? And the family doesn't want to take care of him, right? And he just keeps talking about McDonald's. They're like, okay, we'll take you to McDonald's. We'll take you to McDonald's. And instead, spoilers for this really old movie, it turns out that this is during the days when McDonald and Douglas merged. And he's like, I have a stock certificate for McDonald. It is worth a lot of money now, is what he was trying to say. But he's gone senile, so they don't want to pay attention to him.
That's funny.
Yeah, I don't know. Holy smokes, the internet is awesome. I actually found it. It's called Folks from 1992, starring Tom Selleck.
Yeah. It's not that long ago. What are you talking about, Heidi? Old movie.
Ancient history.
I'm thinking like the 50s.
We bifurcated the whole. Again, we were talking about how age becomes asymptotic, or I'm like eventually becoming infinite years old. There's that split between your birth year begins with 20. There are people who are adults even though their birth year begins at 20, and they can legally drink too in the US of A.
Yeah,
many of them are 21 this year.
That's crazy,
wild. So 92. I mean, you're talking, depending where you draw the line, it's at least a decade prior to them even existing, at least, depending on which 20 is part of their year.
Hmm.
So it's interesting, tomorrow, who will win? Will it be Facebook pulling down the market or Google pulling up the market? I don't know. They're both in the S&P 500.
People getting twitchy. Bad stuff happened in the crypto world today. Solana and the wormhole Ethereum thing. I don't know enough about the crypto world to speak about this intelligently. And they had a bad smart contract. People were able to squirrel out a whole bunch of money out of it.
Ooh, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, so it's just a bad confluence of nervousness about the pandemic, nervousness about...
Well, crypto's been hurting a lot past few months.
You know, tech
it's way down.
Yeah.
The tech was doing pretty badly, but just what day was it? Was it Monday or was it Friday? I forget now. I lose track of when it was, but they had the biggest day ever. And so a lot of companies got their gains back, like Apple's back at 170 now, something like that. Well, I don't know how they did today. But yeah, people are nervous about potential war in Eastern Europe and still worried about COVID. Still worried about inflation. So yeah, there's a lot of reasons for people to be worried. But yeah, let's see. The blockchain bridge wormhole suffers possible exploit worth over $326 million. Wow.
A smart contract was written incorrectly and somebody figured out how to exploit it. As I saw it described, they had a Boolean check that if you had a valid signature that was equal to a Guardian signature, it would get approved. However, somebody had figured out, I have an invalid signature and a non-Guardian signature that also gets approved because those are considered equal. So it's definitely a very terrible bug that led to a whole bunch of money being squirreled out of, I don't know if it's Wormhole or Solana. I'm not sure where exactly they pulled the money out, but there's it was so sort of desperate for them to say, hey, so you've basically done a bug bounty. We'll, if you return the money, we'll give you a whole bunch in return. And I don't think you'll ever see those people again.
No, especially since all the stuff is untraceable. You know what wallet it went into, but you have no idea who owns that wallet. Wallets are just a number. So what did Ethereum stock, or not stock, but the price of Ethereum do today? Let's see. It dropped from 2,700 to around 26.5. Not terrible.
Tim, I learned since our last episode what you had done on, that sounds accusatory, how you had minted the MTJC and Spotcast NFT. Yeah. I didn't realize that OpenSea has a thing called lazy minting where the ultimate buyer, or at least the first buyer, will be the one who pays the gas fees, the Ethereum gas fees.
Oh, really?
So that's how you were able to do it without honing up the money.
Yeah. Okay.
What?
Yeah, because
anybody buy it?
Remember, Mark was saying that normally you would have to pony up the money ahead of time for the gas and to mint it. And we were wondering, how the heck did you just create it without having to pay the money? And it's as OpenSea has a thing called lazy minting that they offer as a feature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me, I got to move some money, some of my Bitcoin around.
Oh, have you looked at your Bitcoin in the last few weeks?
Oh, it goes up and down. It's like a toilet. I'm still way ahead of what I originally invested, so I'm not really worried, you know.
You sure? I don't know how long ago you invested.
It's gone down quite a bit since.
Yeah, it got hit hard last few weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a lot. I mean, it's just, you know, $200 bucks, right? Yeah. So.
There's a coin.cloud crypto ATM in one of the local areas here. And I was like, oh, I might want to try that just for giggles, you know, putting in $20 bills to buy, I think it was like $40 to buy 1 milli Bitcoin, 0.001, I think. I did the math correctly.
So right today it's below 36,700.
Yeah, so there you go. So two crisp $20 bills, and I'll be able to buy
a milli 1 milli Bitcoin. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Oh, OpenSea. That's what you're talking about.
What I don't understand is why the two NFTs have different item activities. Oh, wait. Hold on. Maybe. Oh, yeah, there you go. So when I look at the MTJC logo one, and then you look at the row that says, you know, activities like minted, unit price, from and to, it has a quantity of 100, which I don't understand what that means. Whereas the Spotcast one does not have that quantity.
Yeah, the Spotcast one hasn't been minted. I bought the MTJC one a different way, using that OpenSea thing you were talking about, right?
So the quantity means that there are only 100 of them available to be bought and sold.
To be bought, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what gives them the value. Well, in theory, it gives them the value.
So when you lazy minted these, you minted them differently? So the Spotcast one is the first singular one?
First one I went straight in and minted something or other, and then the second one I went in and looked at how it's done, and I used the OpenSea. I used a different type of coin to back it. Mm-hmm. The first one was backed with Ethereum, I think. And they wanted, like, every time I went to see how much it would cost to mint it, it kept saying, oh, the pricing for minting is really high, don't do it. So I said, nope.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, like Spotcast is on Ethereum blockchain and the MTJC ones are on Polygon.
Oh, yeah. Polygon's much cheaper. Right. Yeah. Much cheaper gas fees.
That was the one.
I feel like this UI could do a better job of rendering that. Like, I shouldn't have to dig into the details to see that, I feel like.
Yeah.
Unless it's more seamless than I am aware of, having never purchased one of these. Because, you know, this looks like a basic e-com sort of setup, right? Make an offer. What's the activity? You know, listings and et cetera. So I kind of get it.
Mm-hmm.
Null address is a very user unfriendly way of saying that, like, there is no but, from.
It's yeah, kind not, of like the, nothing in this space is user friendly. The tools are a mess. So one thing you could do, Tim, just to drum up interest, is have you can define properties on these things. And so, like, you could have different background colors or different foreground colors of the keys, and make some more rare than others. So then people find the rare ones are more desirable. They'll pay more for them, so drives the price up of those, things like that.
Yeah. That's and these people, where are these people who are going to buy these things? Are they
mythical? Well, it's all marketing, right? I mean, people spend millions of dollars on these things.
Yeah.
Collectors, Tim, collectors.
Yeah.
More money than brains, yeah.
Yeah.
People buy stuff. You know, you could, I think, if you actually paid, I guess, apparently the real minting price to make it connected, you could put these on Twitter and have the nice little hexagon unique avatars.
Yeah. So on OpenSea, go to the homepage, top page. And if you scroll down to where it says top collections over the last 7 days, are you there?
Is it OpenSea.io?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you see in the list of top collections, you see number two is Bored Ape Yacht Club.
Yeah.
So this Bored is Ape, kind of the most famous one. You can see the floor price on this is 100 Ethereum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually kind of wondering what that 33,000 is. Is that 33,000 Ethereum? I don't know. But Ethereum's, you know, roughly $2,500 a piece. So even if it's 100 times 2,500 is 250,000 to buy one of these things. And look at them. Now click in. Look at them.
That's, they're like monkeys. Yeah.
Yeah. They're just pictures of monkeys. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
There's a restaurant in New York that's using these exactly the way that I've internalized them, is like the token is interesting from an authorized user. Not an authenticated one. You don't know who it is. It's kind of like a house key or a car key. Whoever holds this has the power. With the NFT image itself being kind of like a cool keychain, you know, Washington Commanders keychain, or you know, Toronto Maple Leafs keychain sort of thing. But there's a restaurant in New York that's opening up that is using the NFT as an exclusivity sort of thing, where they're using it as like a club membership card sort of thing. And it's like 30,000 minimum or something. So it's like, clearly you have to have enough money to have the air of exclusivity to join this essentially country club sort of thing. So I think that is probably the most practical use case I've seen for these.
Hmm.
And you could hypothetically do things with, like, you know, resellers of my account and all sorts of other things with centralized database. But I'm like, I could sell my $30,000 New York restaurant NFT to somebody in Zimbabwe, and it would be just as easy as if they were here in the Seattle area.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But my personal feeling is that all this stuff's going to collapse. I mean, it's just, there's too much out there, not enough real value. It's tulip bulbs. It's going to collapse probably soon.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, it sounds like we're losing Tim.
it's getting late over there.
I'm trying to figure out how to put this up on auction.
So number, what is this? What was in the top number 13 in the last 7 days is Bored Ape Kennel Club, which is a whole bunch of, what are these, Shiba Inus? They're dogs. My significant other's got some art stuff. I could tell her, hey, look, can you make stuff so there's variations, like a paper doll sort of effect, changeable heads, changeable outfits.
Yeah, I was thinking of taking some of our MTJC artwork and making them into NFCs just for fun. Maybe I can draw some monkeys. That would work, right?
Well, and unfortunately, the making of the content is the easy part. It's the convincing people to buy it. That's the hard part.
Well, it's just like anything with, like, building apps, right? Mm-hmm. Who knew people would download our app?
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.